carriers, and they were all not on the same frequency from each other. They were about 100. Actually, one was 110 hertz low, one was 110 hertz high. From one being at 309.441, the closest I can measure, and then channel 13 looked like that was higher than that. And there was another carrier even higher than that. So there were three of them on the same air at the same time as they put my antenna in different directions, not all on the same frequency, three specific carriers. And Dick, you can try this yourself. If you put your radio on AMD code, you can actually hear the beat note between these two. It's a noticeable pitch on any of these carriers. Like if you go on 210.3094, put your radio on AM, you'll hear what I'm talking about. If you got this stuff from Providence coming at the same time you're getting in New York.
Yeah, there's my next question for Eric. Eric, when it comes to true Channel 13 frequency range over the air, where are the nearest ones to New York City? Over to you, Eric.
Okay, actually, I can give you the answer to that in a minute. You will notice that the way some manufacturers' exciters work is not exactly the same as other manufacturers' exciters work. The pilot, however you measure the pilot, even with certain test equipment, you will find it different. But the actual number comes out. The pilot is related to the edge of the signal, as far as the FCC is concerned, not the absolute frequency. Some people are running off a crystal. Some people are running off of GPS-controlled oscillators. And I know there's a difference between the Harris exciter and a difference between the Talus exciter. So the fact that you see things on a different frequency is sort of irrelevant in the real world. Let's put it that way.
By way of the FCC rules, even though it's edge channel related, not exact center frequency, what do you believe is the maximum, what we would call frequency error, that we're likely to see? Is 120 hertz about as much as we're likely to see? Could they be 1 kilohertz wrong and still be within FCC rules? Eric, go ahead.
I doubt you'll find anything that's 1 kilohertz wrong. But you'll see some differences from station to station and manufacturer to manufacturer. I'll give you an example. Hewlett Packard makes a really wonderful device to measure the HBSB signal with, and you will get a similar MER, mean error rate of, say, 38 dB. And you use a Tektronix, which is supposed to do the same thing, will get you a mean error rate of 41 dB. Each manufacturer's gear will say that the pilot is exactly offset by such and such and such. I don't remember what the number is anymore, but they will be consistent about that part of it. As far as how you generate the pilot, it's not like you have an oscillator going somewhere and you generate a signal and that becomes the pilot. All this stuff is done by DSP. There is no hardware. It's all math.
Boy, we've got a lot to learn. Okay, before we put everyone to sleep, I'm going to go over to the other people who have signed in. Mr. GSE, Golf Sierra Echo, I think it was. Give us your full call letters and name, sir, and then proceed with your question or comment. KQRIW, my name is Dick.
Yeah, it's KV4GFD. It's Rob over here in Glenville, Connecticut, the volunteer firefighter. Dick. Hello, Dick and Mel and everyone else on the net. This question is directed over to Eric, since we heard you talking about FCC here and some bands there. We were notified by one of the chiefs there that the FCC, I believe in 2013, is going to be requesting our passing that some of our radios be switched over to the narrow band, which we're operating on the 154.175 there. Have you heard anything about this, that they're switching some of the emergency departments over to the narrow band? Back to you, Eric.
There's a couple people that they're not here tonight. They can answer that a little better. If you're really curious about that stuff, you can go to the FCC website, and they show you what's going on. You can actually find that information. But from what I understand, Homeland Security is driving a certain amount of stuff, and it's all based on interoperability, which really, if New York City Police Department wants this particular system and New York City Fire Department wants that particular system, that's the problem that they've been having for years, and it hasn't changed yet. So I really couldn't give you an answer on that, but you can actually find it on the web if you really do a little looking.
Yeah, copy on that. Well, Connecticut, I believe, was the first state to comply with the ITAC system there, with, where I was able to contact between state troopers and the other local departments there. You know, what is the flip? Unit can turn around and actually talk with the dispatch of a state trooper or another emergency service there. We're running, a lot of us are running the HT-1000s there. Now, I guess that's on the wideband. Is that radio capability of going to narrowband?
Well, again, I'm not, I'm more up on the broadcast stuff rather than on the emergency services and the commercial stuff, so, I'm not going to give you an answer because I'd be talking through my head. If you should happen to run into WB2JSC on his repeater, or on his repeater, I'm sure he could give you a very good answer.
Help me out there, and we'll pass it back over there, Dick. There, Dick. Again, thank you very much, there. Yes, that is a fence on my truck there. The last time you looked. All right, this is KB4GFD in Greenwich, Connecticut. We'll be on the side.
Are those call letters Golf, Foxtrot, Delta?
That is correct. Golf, Fox, Delta. The G stands for Greenwich, and the F stands for fire, and the D stands for department. And the 4 is for the station, and I'm stationed at. Back to you.
WH4YY.
Well done. Joe, you've got it.
A good many of the Motorola radios made that are 10 years older and going forward from that about that time probably have the capability of going to narrow bands on a per personality basis. I own several radios that are capable of doing that. If I put like FRS frequencies in, they're like half the deviation of a regular channel. That's on a per personality basis. I believe an HD-1000 is capable of doing a 12.5 kilohertz channel, which will make the deviation go to half deviation, and it narrows the receiver's bandwidth also. If you're using an old base station like an MSR 2000 or MSF 5000, they're probably not capable of going to narrow band deviation.
I got a quick question for you, Bob. How many people have asked you, is there really a white fence on top of your vehicle?
You're the only one, Dick. Actually, the only one. KB1IFY, as a matter of fact, looked at it and turned around and said, what were you looking at? Back to you.
Yeah, the way the picture is taken, there's a white fence in the background that looks like it's on top of the emergency lights in your vehicle, which of course is not there at all. Okay, any further comments there, Joe, you want to make? And sorry, I wasn't paying proper attention to what you just said. For B2RYY, K2RIW.
I just said many of the Motorola radios made from 10 years ago going forward are capable of going to narrow band deviation. Most of the mobile space stations, portables, are capable of doing that kind of thing on a per-personality basis in the radio. Stuff older than 10 years, like a MaxTrak GM300, for example, as far as mobile radios, are not capable of going to narrow band. Same with the respective base stations like an MSR-2000, MSF-5000, they're not capable of going to a narrow band deviation type of operation. Those you'd probably have to replace.
Yeah, let me ask you, I'm going to ask Eric first and then Joe second. My understanding, if the radio is going to start receiving what I would call digital data, I think you wouldn't want to do it with a narrow band channel, a narrow band IF strip. I think digital data and narrowband are somewhat incompatible. Does that mean that the newest radios are not going to be very easy to switch over by just changing a module inside in order to handle the newer digital data. I may be overly simplistic on this. Eric first, KE2EJ, K2RIW. Okay, Joe, you have an opinion on that, or am I asking a really crazy question?
I haven't looked at the schematic to know the specifics of, but I measured on a generator. You are actually narrowing the receiver bandwidth to a much narrower state from one to another. When you put you make the channel go to like 2.5 kilohertz, you start trying to put 5 kilohertz deviation of things. Audio, I think it distorts like pretty seriously. But you think there'd be a problem sending data, huh? I'm not surprised because the bands are so crowded up on the VHF band, for example, and the channel spacing is the standard 15 kilohertz spacing. I'm not surprised they want to try to narrow that to probably half of that to try to get more stations on the band.
Okay, one of the experiments that I did 10 or so years ago was to take a medium band and a narrow band IF strip and transmit pure sine wave FM modulated audio down each. And I was using a sine add meter. And what I rapidly discovered is that the total harmonic distortion that you get out of a more narrow channel, irrespective of the quality of the audio being put into the transmitter and the linearity of the transmitter. I could take a extremely high quality 1 kilohertz sine wave, put it into an extremely high kilohertz FM modulator with 1 kilohertz of audio, and out comes a very characteristic narrowband FM signal with extremely well-recognized amplitude of the individual spectral sidebands. The Bessel sidebands of that waveform are very well recognized. Put that narrowband FM signal into a narrowband IF strip, and because it is attenuating the higher Bessel functions differently, both in amplitude and phase, that when the discriminator tries to demodulate that, it will be limited to, let me pick a number, 20 dB of total harmonic distortion, 15 dB, some number like that. If you had a requirement to meet 30 or 40 dB of total harmonic distortion, you cannot do it in a typical Gaussian-shaped narrowband filter, and I'm reasonably sure you cannot do it with a rectangular-shaped brick wall filter, because those individual Bessel functions must come through with a particular phase and amplitude relationship, and a narrowband channel cannot do that. That leads me to believe that digital data will have a lot more trouble getting down a narrowband channel than a medium band or a wideband channel. That's my first gut feel on those set of experiments that I did roughly 10 years ago. To be KYY, KQRIW, for me.
Okay, I've purposely tried using my radios in, I think I had the radios, this radio and the, not the one I'm using now, but another one, out of Dane, we tried up between 2 amps, we tried going narrow band and like regular 5 kHz deviation, and what we noticed was we went to 2.5 kc deviation on a very similar frequency. Your noise picks up in the bottom and you don't have the same threshold. In other words, the signal seems to not go over the background noise as easily. It seems to give you a lot more, I guess interference with your signal itself. It reduces your signal to noise threshold quite a bit, or your ratio, and it's quite noticeable. The radio works okay, but the thing is, it just seems like the noise floor as it comes up and makes the signal a little less intelligible. That's the basic thing I've learned or noticed with the user radios at that kind of deviation level. Well, that's going to be a major problem as they get all these people to do this later on. I don't know.
Well, you're right on, George. I mean, Joe. If I take a FM broadcast radio, which is plus or minus 75 kilohertz of peak deviation, and it's going through an IF strip that's 200 kc wide, and if I didn't bother putting a squelch control on the receiver, as I tune between a channel and in between channels, I get noise. You get a little bit of noise in the background, not much. make a plus or minus 5 KC deviation designed radio system, and if you didn't have the squelch control operating correctly, when that signal goes away, the blast of noise you get in the background is huge. It's deafening. Very unpleasant. That's why they've all got a squelch control. As I said, on the FM broadcast radio, you almost don't need a squelch control. And if I go to narrow band, plus or minus 2, 2.5 KC instead of 5, that problem's going to get worse. What's really going on is the amount of power of audio on FM modulation is a function of deviation squared, just like a power of a voltage is E squared over R. Voltage squared gives you power. Deviation squared gives you audio power. So your audio is falling off real fast as you use narrowband FM modulation. Intuitively, you'd say a more narrow IF strip is going to give you a better threshold than microvolts. Maybe so, but it's not going to sound as good. So when you go down to 2 KC radios, the good news is you can squeeze more people in there, but they don't sound as nice. And boy, the squelch control is a hell of a lot more required, because the blast of noise you get without a signal being present becomes more and more intolerable. From A2RYY, K2RYW in the TechNet.
I agree with what you're saying. I do agree.
Now, we probably put Paul to bed, WS2N. If Paul, because he's got to get to work tomorrow, we catch him up awful late. Paul, if you're still there, tell us anything about space. What is NASA doing? WS2N, if you're there, I hope you are. K2RYW in the TechNet. Yeah, we waited too long for him. And Mel, what kind of mail have you had this week? And I've waited too long for that. But some of these other subjects are kind of fascinating. K2KEY, tell us anything. K2RYW.
Can I just ask something about, you asked me about a stage report, about something I heard on the on a recent program as far as dealing with astronomy?
Go for it. Astronomy is my favorite subject.
I know it's a bad habit, not waiting for the beep, but I should discipline myself better. I understand now that they have radio telescopes that are not only looking at things optical and radio, but they're also looking for things like laser type signatures, which is something where they said a star could produce something in the range of a billionth of a second. Have you heard much about that?
It's kind of obvious, as you go to higher and higher frequencies, a fixed-size antenna can give you a more and more narrow beamwidth. You can really focus that signal, and you can send it to a much longer distance. So there are various people, when it comes to a SETI search for extraterrestrial intelligence, who are speculating that if we're ever going to measure a signal from some other intelligence, it might very well be a laser signal. It might be very brief in modulation, and so on. So yes, to my knowledge, the optical telescope people are doing all kinds of analysis of the stars they're looking at to find out whether or not the light is being modulated. And there's all kinds of modulations of the light coming out of the star. In the case of the Cepheid variables, which is the best reference they got for distance measurement of various galaxies from ours, measuring the period of a Cepheid variable allows you to determine the size of it, therefore its intrinsic brightness, and when you measure the amount of illumination you get from that star, and you know how much intrinsic brightness it has, you can therefore figure out what the range is. Well, there are various people saying that in the case of pulsars, some of them are going down to the milliseconds and microseconds periods as far as looking for what's going on there. So there's all kinds of optical astronomy going on where they're looking for modulation of various kinds. And I think it's only the next logical step where you start looking for brief pulses, which might be the intelligence. That might be a very nice way of sending data. So I know it's taking place. I haven't seen a specific program or read an article on it, but I've been hearing hints along these lines. Over to you, Joe. I'm H-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-Y-W in the TechNet.
Yeah, I happened to watch that, I believe, on the Science Channel about a week or so ago. And it was actually fascinating to sit down and watch it for a while. It caught my attention quite a bit. So it sounded like something, you know, relatively new as far as what they were doing, but maybe it's not that new.
Well, we have put a particular satellite in space, which is looking for the light modulation that takes place when a planet passes in front of that particular star. And I think it's called Kepler, but I'm not sure right now is the name of the project. And it's now in operation, and it's now going to count the number of stars where we can see the planets going in front of them. And that's one of the next most sensitive ways of finding Earth-sized planets. Up till now, we've been looking for the Doppler shift of the spectral lines coming out of the star, caused by the wobble of the star, caused by the gravitational pull of the planets going around the star. Well, that's a great technique for measuring Jupiter-sized planets, but for something Mercury and Earth size and Mars size, that's not a very sensitive technique. This other technique of occultation of the star passing in front, even though it's got a low probability of happening for all the alignments to be right, we've still got so many zillions of stars to look at. You're going to find a certain percentage of them. You're going to find Earth-sized planets. And so that operation is going on right now. So there you're looking for light modulation at a very slow rate, but I guarantee the hardware that's doing it has the raw data of any other kind of modulation. And I'd like to believe they're smart enough to look at the data both in the fast mode and the slow mode, if you know what I mean. Over to you, Joe. I'll wait for the beep.
Okay. So the whole thing is fascinating. Back over to you, and then over to get K2KY. See if you can answer some mail big. So.
Yeah, we're going to get a lot of slack if we don't go through at least one or two letters tonight, Mel. K2KY, K2RAW.
This is K2KEY. Like I said, some of them are from young amateurs and all. I usually give them the answers and don't, you know, promise them that we'll bring it up here on the tech network. Most likely, good chance we won't get to it. So I just pick out some ones here and there. I was just going to make one comment about, but it's getting late, so I'll just pick out here. I've had a number of people that asked me that they are building projects, and there used to be a manual, you know, that they have around for finding transistors. The manual was put out by, I believe it's ECG, or the SK series, and they said they can't seem to find those manuals anymore. Is there any kind of a disk or whatever around, or anybody know of any source where they could find, you know, look up simple transistors and integrated circuits for projects, Dick, over.
G2QAQ.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, Mel, where I do it all the time, if I have a part number of a transistor that I'm interested in, if they have a computer handy to them, just type in the most complete part number that they have of that transistor into Google or some search engine, and you'd be amazed at how many PDF files will come up immediately with all the information on that transistor, thermal information, electrical gain, everything you could possibly want to know about that transistor, including mechanicals and pinouts.
Yeah, if you've already got the transistor, that's a great approach. Although I'm a little bit worried that what Mel's questioner is asking is that, how do I know what transistor I should be using? In other words, is there a general manual that shows me what Radio Shack has got in the bubble pack so I know what's easily available? If I'm doing a project with audio, what transistor should I use? If I'm doing a project at 1 megacycle, 100 megacycles, 1,000 megacycles, what transistor should I be using? Maybe that's what the questioner is asking. What do you think, Mel?
Pretty much right, Dick. For instance, I had a question today. Somebody asked me if he needed 2N2222, and he had some other numbers. Are they just, you know, usable? Are they the same transistor? Now, of course, when you had some of those old books, I know I have some of those books around. If I looked up that transistor, they would give me like an ECG, or if I looked up in the SK manual, which was RCA, they'd give me an SK number, and then if I cross-referenced to the transistor, another transistor I had maybe in my odds and ends drawer, if they had the same SK number or ECG number, you know, they could understand that they would be basically the same transistor, Dick, over.
The good news is that if the transistor you're about to, let me backtrack. What we amateurs do, two-thirds of the time, is we look at somebody's schematic diagram, and we say, gee, I'd like to build that widget, but I don't have exactly those parts. So what you do is you go into your junk box, and you choose all the parts you think that are close. You put them on the table and find out if you can make it work with the parts you've got in hand. In the case of a transistor, as long as the voltage tolerance from collector to emitter is high enough, that's a good step. Most transistors, we used to in the old days worry about what is the HFE gain, the current gain between base and collector. You almost don't have to worry about that anymore. High gain, low gain, they all work. The next thing you worry about is, does it have enough frequency response? Does it have enough voltage capability? And you got to be a little bit careful in that if you're building a circuit that runs at 1 megacycle and you've got a transistor that's good to 1,000 megacycles, you got to be a lot more careful with the layout, because your particular layout may have a stray inductance that's big enough at 1,000 megs, but it takes off and oscillates on it, whereas if you used a lower frequency transistor, it wouldn't. So as long as you obey certain rules, you'd be amazed how adaptable transistors are. The transistor section of the Radio Amateur's Handbook gives you quite a bit of data, quite a bit of help. It's not perfect. These other manuals you mentioned are more thorough, but they're not as available anymore. And if the guy already has the transistor in hand, Glenn's suggestion, if you just type it into Google, you'll get a PDF data sheet that tells you everything you want to know. With a little bit of learning, you'll eventually discover that many transistors can be used in applications you never thought were possible. The wording from the data sheet of the manufacturer would lead you to believe that it's got to be used in exactly this location for this purpose and nothing else will work. In many cases, the biggest thing you got to worry about is NPN versus PNP. That's polarity problem. Are you running on a positive power supply or a negative power supply? You got to get that one right. But many of the others, you can sometimes really stretch the rules. Most of these transistors these days are only worth 30 cents a piece. If you burn one up, it's not the end of the world. Try it, you'll like it. K2KEY, wait for the beep, K2RIW.
Okay, yeah, well, that's, I could say, these manuals were made it very simple, because it really gave you, you know, a good selection of transistors that fell into the same category as, in other words, if you had the necessity to use the, you know, the transistor was bad in the circuit, you were fixing something, and you got the number off the transistor, you looked it up, you got the ECG or the SK number, and then you looked through your collection and see if you had that number and all. So it made it very simple. Yes, I understand you can get the characteristics of it, but to try to, you know, then look up all your odds and ends transistors and find, you know, going through one at a time and then putting it up there and punching it in and all that kind of stuff, I could see could be very tedious, whereas thumbing through it, you know, in one of those old manuals was pretty quick. And the fact I had a situation just recently, I repaired a radio, and I went crazy, literally. I was on the phone quite a while trying to get components for it. Looking through the big catalog almost drove me crazy, Dick. It would have been much simpler if there would have been, you know, an up-to-date catalog for it, Dick, over.
Way back in the dark ages, 25 years ago, there was a particular issue of Electronic Design News which listed almost every single transistor from 2N21 up to 2N4000, so to speak, with a bunch of vertical columns telling you the basic data: power dissipation, voltage tolerance, NPN, PNP, gain, maximum frequency, and so on. They don't do that anymore. So a simple manual like that where you can look them up in a hurry, I think almost doesn't exist. There might not even be one of these $1.50 manuals in Radio Shack anymore that's got that. It is a problem. to look up each individual one on Google is a pain. But maybe if a guy takes all the transistors in his junk box and sets himself up a notebook with some preliminary data on each one, that could be a valuable reference for what he owns to be used for later projects. So maybe that's an investment worth making. Other than that, to try to buy that general manual today, that could be very troublesome. I don't know if anybody prints one anymore, like the old RCA transmitting tube manual, for instance. Over to you, Mel, KQLAW, right to the beat.
Roger, I thought maybe I didn't, wasn't keeping up with it. Maybe there was a disc, maybe instead of a printed manual like they had the ECG or the FK, that maybe they updated it to some kind of a disc that you could pop into your computer and do the same thing basically as you did by thumbing through the manual. But it could be a real misery today. I happened to fix a radio. I salvaged basically, was in, going in a garbage pail, a very nice piece of equipment, but because of the damage to the radio, it was prohibitive to repair. When I called the manufacturer up, they literally told me that, you know, this is a board replacement project, and that they don't do component down to component level repairs on those boards anymore. So I went ahead and did all that troubleshooting on it, found the failed components, and there was a number of them. And of course, I had, I got a big catalog. I got a couple of big digital catalogs and all, and trying to find these parts in the digikey and everything. It was a project. Like, I spent a huge amount of time trying to run down these parts. If I could have just take the part number and, cross-reference it quickly, I could see in my case that it would have saved me a lot of grief. Over.
KC2, QIQ.
Go right ahead, Glenn.
Mel, just as a quick goof, I typed into Google a transistor substitution guide, and about 100 different websites all popped up, and everything from books that they sell on it through all different kinds of places to certain websites where you can type in transistor numbers and it comes up with the substitute values and the data sheets. It still might just be an interesting thing to try. Just type in transistor substitution guide on Google and just see what comes back, and that might be half of what you're looking for right there. KC2, QIQ.
Maybe it still exists, Mel.
That's what I had said to these people. I said, see if you can find an ECG or FK book exists. And they said, no, they couldn't find it. And they said, these other manuals, is similar to most of them, just give you the characteristics. You can find it, the device in there, and the characteristics. And then if you have another one that's similar, you think, you got to look up the characteristics. They, you know, it was simple just to have a direct reference number, which they don't seem to print. They asked around, and it doesn't seem to be anybody has such a thing available. They've made it a lot more complicated, Dick, over.
The substitution guides that used to exist, by my standards, were overly severe. In other words, they wanted a substitution device where it had the exact same die inside, in the exact same package, and the exact same lead layout. I have, on a number of occasions, chose a transistor that had approximately the same power dissipation, voltage, and frequency capability, but was in an entirely different package, and I had to crisscross leads before replugging them into a PC board, and I've done things like that, and it's worked like a charm. So my first impression is these equivalency guides are much too severe, that there's a lot more leeway you've got if you've got a little bit of smarts. We've got 1 minute before we're going to be closed out, Mel. This was TechNet number 1,270 of the series that began in September of 1982, 27 years ago. Assuming that these two old guys, Mel and Dick, stay healthy, hopefully they'll be back next week and try to delve into a little bit more of this electronics, and we'll almost start understanding it all. That plus some astronomy. 73, be kind to each other. Try to help your friends in Bayville to recognize that that radio is their friend, not their enemy. K2KEY, go ahead, Mel. K2LAW.
to say goodnight, and yeah, the old manual is nice because if you had a selection, you know, if you wanted to look up for regulators, they had a section on regulators and section
next
on
tonight at 8:30. Welcome to
whatever amplifier devices and all. If you had the numbers, you could look up real quick, and you don't get in the ballpark. But all right, be it as it is, I guess things have just it's more complicated than this. Complicated business, I should say. 73 is all. See you next week. This is K2KEY. Good night.
Hello, test. Hello, test. Hello, test.
Reflector 9126, link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the New England Reflector 912.
Channel 6.
Radio Newsline report number 1682 with the release date of Friday, November 6, 2009 to follow in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. The following is a QST. Georgia Hams are given a $165,000 grant to build the D-Star Rescue Radio Network. Two hams help save a life on Catalina Island. And two preteens come up with a cheap solution to the digital reception problem in the USA. Find out the details on Amateur Radio Newsline Report number 1682, coming your way right now.
From around the world, this is Newsline, Amateur Radio's first independent on-the-air news and bulletin service. Now reporting from Auckland, New Zealand, here is Jim Meacham, ZL2BHF.
It's one of the largest government grants ever given to ham radio emergency communication. This, as $165,000 in federal funding, has been secured by Georgia Emergency Management Agency to complete a statewide D-Star-based ham radio emergency communications network. Amateur Radio Newsline's David Black, KB4KCH, has the story of the grant and all the digital rescue radio network that it will create.
The network's creation is the result of a dream that started in 2005, according to John Davis, WB4QDX. That's when a vision was born for what amateur radio emergency communications could one day achieve in the state of Georgia. Mark Felick, WA6NGC, is the former director of engineering for the state's public broadcasting system. When the opportunity arose to install two amateur radio antennas on each of 9 television towers providing statewide coverage, Felig jumped into action. He designated Georgia's Amateur Radio Emergency Service to control the use of those sites for emergency communications. The next task was to figure out the best technology to use at those sites. Linked FM repeaters and packet were among the modes considered. But Georgia's radio amateurs were also watching emerging D-Star technology. They recognized it as a state-of-the-art platform providing simultaneous voice and data communications. Knowing that D-Star also allows repeaters to be linked on a flexible basis and that it permits simultaneous voice and low-speed data along with high-speed internet connectivity at 1.2 gigahertz, and the decision was made to go D-Star for the state's new system. When the network is finished, radio amateurs will have access to voice and data repeaters on all 9 towers across the state, operating on 2 meters, 440 megahertz, and 1.2 gigahertz. Because those towers are strategically located to provide maximum public television coverage, amateur radio communications will benefit from wide area coverage too. Commercial-grade inch and 5/8 transmission lines will connect the antennas, which will be between 500 and 600 feet above ground. Georgia's public broadcasting network will provide indoor space for equipment along with backup power at each site. Internet access will be available too, thanks to the broadcasting system's DS3 data network. This means flexible linking of repeaters will be possible using a stock D-Star interface. The federal money will also pay for 20 dual-band D-Star radios to be installed at EMA offices across the state, along with a portable UHF D-Star repeater available for emergency deployment. In addition, 3 1.2 gigahertz D-Star radios with laptops for sending data and photos from field locations will also be purchased. The money will also be used to build a robust reflector to serve the state's network during emergency conditions and also for general use during non-emergency times. 2 of the emergency network's D-Star repeaters are already on the air. One is located at Pembroke, Georgia, near Savannah. The second operates from atop Stone Mountain, serving the Atlanta metro area. The complete Georgia D-Star Amateur Radio Emergency Communications Network is expected to be in operation in early 2010. For the Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm David Black, KB4KCH from the Southeast Bureau in Birmingham, Alabama.
The Georgia network will complement other D-Star-based emergency communication systems planned or in operation in the neighboring states of Alabama, Florida, and South Carolina. Once all are in operation, it will create a regional ham radio emergency capability across the American Southeast. This monetary grant is only second in size to one of $250,000 given by the governor of Oregon in 2007 to that state's ham radio first responders. This to build a Winlink-based statewide amateur radio emergency communications network. Carl So, KI6PCW, and wife Deborah Ava, KJ6CRZ, put their ham radio emergency training to use to help rescue an unidentified man after an accident on Catalina Island. This as the recently trained volunteer ham radio operators rescued a man after he fell more than 40 feet onto rocks below. So and Ava are both of Topanga, California, which is a Los Angeles suburb, and are members of the Topanga Disaster Radio Team. The couple had climbed a hill on Catalina Island to check out a repeater when they saw a 61-year-old man bleeding and moaning. So, and Ava had their handheld radios with them. They used the equipment to make contact with other radio amateurs on the California mainland, who called 911 to report the emergency. Los Angeles County firefighter paramedics responded, and the injured man was quickly flown by medevac helicopter to St. Mary's Hospital in Long Beach for treatment. Authorities say that the couple's quick thinking and knowledge of ham radio helped save the injured man's life. The Topanga disaster radio team they work with is part of the Topanga Coalition for Emergency Preparedness. GAREC 2010, the next global amateur radio emergency communications conference, will take place next fall in Curico. The dates will be October 11th and 12th, with the theme of the meeting to be Learning Through Practicing. More details of next October's gathering will be announced as they become available. Meantime, keep an eye on the conference website for updates. The URL can be found in this week's printed Amateur Radio Newsline report. Ham Radio is joining the worldwide campaign to help find a cure for acquired immune deficiency syndrome, better known by the acronym AIDS. Bruce Tennant, K6PZW, has more.
To do its part to conquer this killer disease, a special amateur radio station will be operating at the Joint United Nations Program on HIV/AIDS, or UNAIDS headquarters in Geneva, Switzerland. This from December 1st to the 7th, using the special event call sign 4U1AIDS. The operation is part of an invitation from UNAIDS to all peoples globally to observe World AIDS Day and demonstrate global HIV awareness. Begun on December 1, 1988, the aim of World AIDS Day is to raise money, increase awareness, fight prejudice, and improve education regarding HIV and AIDS. UNAIDS estimates there are now 33.2 million people living with HIV, including 2.5 million children. Those who hold QSOs with 4U1AIDS on any three bands will be awarded a special commemorative World AIDS Day Award certificate. Amateur radio stations that have radio contact with 4U1AIDS on five bands will be awarded a special commemorative UNAIDS pennant. All contacts will be sent a special 4U1AIDS QSL card. The Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Bruce Tennant, K6PZW in Los Angeles.
For further information, please contact with Andre Federal, UNAIDS, 20 Avenue Appiah, CH1211, Geneva 27, Switzerland. Some good news for our listeners to the north. After months of negotiations between Radio Amateurs of Canada and telecommunications regulator Industry Canada, the first two licenses granted to Canadians for experiments at 504 to 509 kHz have been issued. This in preparation for the 2012 World Radio Communications Conference. Jack Leahy, VE1ZZ, has been assigned callsign VX9PSO in the developmental service for his experimental transmissions. Joe Craig, VO1NA, has been assigned the callsign VX9MRC. Both of these stations have been on the air already, with VX9PSO having been reported at 504.6 kHz and 5X9MRC at 507.77 kHz. And this late news, Finbar O'Connor, EI0CF in County Donegal Island, reports that he's had a QSO with Joe Craig, VX9MRC. He says that Joe was on 507.77 kHz while he was on 507.056 kHz. The mode was CW using straight Morse keys. This is the first island to Canada contact on the 500 kHz band. From the United States of America, we are the Amateur Radio Newsline, heard on bulletin stations around the world, including the N7GAD Puget Sound Amateur Radio Club repeater serving Seattle, Washington. Thailand's 7 MHz expansion has received a go-ahead from that nation's telecommunications regulator. John Gargan, W2YR, reports that he's just received information from the International Secretary of the Radio Amateurs Society of Thailand that the Thai National Telecommunications Council has approved the Society's recent request for the expansion of 40 metres, this giving hams and that nation a primary status of 7.0 to 7.2 MHz. For those not aware, this is the same band plan that had been approved internationally at the WRC03 conference and was to be effective March 29 this year, pending approval on a country-by-country basis. For Thailand, it happens about the time this week's newscast goes to air on Friday, November 6. The 500th ARIS classroom to space station contact has taken place. On Tuesday, October 27th, ISS Commander Frank DeWinney ON1DWN answered questions from students at the new Copernic Science Center in Warsaw, Poland. This was the 500th school contact since ARIS began operations in 2000. This was a telebridge contact operated by ARIS ground station Oshane-Lim VK4KHZ located in Queensland, Australia. At the end of the contact, DeWinney thanked Lind for the many years of providing ARIS telebridge contact. Lind, in turn, shared these thanks with his colleagues of the 11 other telebridge ground stations, which cover all five continents. Still with ham radio space and educational news, word that the ARISAT-1 development team is inviting school students from around the world to submit papers or other visual items that will be flown on that ham radio satellite. Submission should be in JPEG or PDF format, such as a paper or a study done on science, technology, engineering or math. Also accepted will be items such as drawing of spacecraft, schematic, a journal kept on an educational topic, a story, photo or news article about a class doing a hands-on educational project. To take part, the student or teacher should submit the material by email to Dave Jordan, aa4kn@ansat.org, and also copy to gaston.vertels@skynet.be. They will check that contact is appropriate to students and select those to fly on ARISAT-1. The deadline for submissions is on Sunday, November the 15th. The FCC has issued a $2,500 fine to Frankie Grover of Lakeland, Florida. This for operating an unlicensed transmitter on 87.9 MHz from a location known as the Kingston Lakeside Inn and using the unassigned call letters WGBC-FM. According to the FCC, its agents used direction finding to locate the signal. On August 18, 2009, the Tampa office issued a notice of apparent liability for forfeiture to Mr. Grover in the amount of $10,000. Grover submitted a response to the NAL. He admitted to operating the station, but requested a reduction or cancellation of the proposed forfeiture, saying the level of proposed fine would pose a financial hardship. He also provided the FCC with the required financial records to prove his claim. The FCC accepted his evidence and has reduced the fine to $2,500, which he was given the customary 30 days to pay or to file a further appeal. You'll probably remember the story of Irma Frosto of Compton, California, that we reported on a few weeks ago. Her amplified TV antenna allegedly self-oscillated on 840 MHz and caused interference to a cell site. The FCC sent her a citation, even though there was nothing in the commission's write-up to suggest that she knew about the self-oscillations or had the wherewithal to eliminate them. Well, now Irma has company. A 12-year-old schoolboy in Great Britain by the name of Nicky Chamberlain has been busted because his self-oscillating TV antenna was interfering with air traffic over his home in Minslade's Beds in the UK. The Ofcom engineer ordered the father to dispose of the aerial immediately. Air traffic controllers first noticed the communication problem on the flight path into London's Luton Airport on October 6. According to Ofcom, pilots coming in to land at the airport were losing contact with the control tower because the faulty antenna preamp was transmitting on the same frequency as the aircraft radio. Saturday, November 14th is the date the International Amateur Radio Union will activate Global Set 2009. This is a global simulated emergency test running from 1800 to 2200 UTC that encourages hams worldwide to pass simulated emergency traffic using standard national traffic system format. The drill is being billed as a great opportunity for all radio amateurs to observe and practice important traffic passing skills. These are skills that are deemed fundamental to the role of amateur radio in crisis communications conditions. Rules and a list of participating stations may be found at www.iaru-r1.com. www.newenglandreflector.org. Search under the heading Emergency Communications Working Group. Federal regulators are considering taking back some spectrum from television broadcasters and auctioning it off to wireless companies. This so as to increase the availability of wireless broadband services for the general public. Federal Communications Commission Chairman Julius Genachowski has warned that the US does not have enough of the airwaves set aside for wireless broadband service in the future. He notes that his agency is looking at a variety of ways to remedy that shortage. At this stage, FCC officials are mostly trying to get input from broadcasters and others. The proposal will be released in February 2010. TV station owners are likely to fight the plan, although the FCC is envisioning paying broadcasters for any airwaves that are repossessed and auctioned away. The Southeastern VHF Society is calling for the submission of papers and presentations for the 14th Annual Southeastern VHF Society Conference. The event is slated to be held at Morehead State University in Morehead, Kentucky on April 23rd through the 24th of 2010. The deadline for the submission is February 5. For more information, please visit www.sevhfs.org on the World Wide Web. Some names in the news. The New Zealand Ministry of Economic Development has announced that it will welcome FCC spectrum experts William Sharkey and Mark Wykowski to lecture down under. Both are senior economists at the FCC Office of Strategic Planning in Washington, D.C. The two will present a seminar on current research and spectrum allocation issues and auctions. And from Los Angeles comes word that our own producer, Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF, has retired from Fox Television after a career that spanned close to three decades at the network's flagship station, KTTV. He started in 1980 as a bench technician maintaining three-quarter-inch pneumatic video cassette recorders used by the station's news operation. Over the years, he did just about every job one finds at a television station. He says that the last 12 years, working as the engineering contact with the news department, have been the ones he's enjoyed the most. There, he's not only worked on the technical side, but also has been on the air several times as an expert on all things electronic and radio communications for news stories, reported by Hal Eisner, Phil Stewman, and others. Bill tells Newsline that he's only retired from broadcasting, but not from life. He says that he has a number of projects he wants to undertake, including the production of a television documentary on a medical researcher and completing the script for a two-act stage play. He'll also be continuing his VHF column in World Radio Magazine and producing these weekly amateur radio newsline reports. That, coupled with a wife, daughter, son-in-law, and four very active grandkids, will keep Bill a very busy 67-year-old boy. Pictures of his surprise retirement party, put on by his many friends at KTTV, are on Bill's photo album page on the Facebook social networking service. Look for his album under the name Bill Pasternak, plus titled Saying Goodbye to KTTV after almost 30 years. Someone else retiring is ARRL President Joel Harrison, W5ZN. Late last week, Harrison announced that he's decided not to seek re-election when his current term expires on January 16, 2010. Joel Harrison served two terms as ARRL president. He began his ham radio political career in 1983 when he became the section manager in the League's Arkansas section. Subsequently, he served as Delta Division director and as an ARRL vice president. In 2000, he was first elected first vice president. He was elected League President in 2006. Coming to you this week from beneath the Southern Cross in Auckland, New Zealand, this is Ham Radio News for today's Radio Amateur. We are the Amateur Radio Newsline, with links to the world from our only official website at www.arnewsline.org and being relayed by the volunteer services of the following Radio Amateur. Some sad news to report. Word that former ARRL director Paul Vadami, WB2VUK of Tarrytown, New York, passed away October 22nd from a brain aneurysm. Paul Vadami had a long record of volunteer service with the ARRL. Prior to becoming director, he served as section manager for the Eastern New York section from 1980 to 1996 and as vice director from 1987 to 1996. In those days, vice directors were once allowed to serve simultaneously as section managers. Vardani was elevated from vice director to director, when then director Steve Mendelson, W2ML, was elected ARRL first vice president. But he resigned as director in September of 1996, citing job and church obligations as preventing him from doing what he considered a proper job of fulfilling his duties